A few words about Hazrat Ali alayhi salam and Nahjul Balagha. The sermons, letters, and lectures of Hazrat Ali are no longer of disputed authenticity. Those who have read them with care know that they have that distinct ring of a great informing consciousness. To say in a few words something relevant about a book that has been the subject of countless multi-volume commentaries is to be naive. I will simply put down here what to me is the startling feature of the book and the man who spoke these words. First, the man. Hazrat Ali was the foremost of the companions, friend, and warlike, grant him this. There are four things that no one shared with him, said a friend on his passing. He was the first to confess the faith. He was one who slept on the Prophet's bed on the night of Hijrat. He was one whom the Prophet called his own brother in the mosque of Medina on the occasion of Mukhaf, brotherhood. And he was the one who conducted the last rites of the Prophet when he went on to God. The Prophet was the perfect human exemplar of obedience to God. Ali was the perfect exemplar of obedience to the Prophet. This is surely a simple way to put the fact of this greatness on record. Hazrat Ali, who also lived 63 years like the Prophet, testified by his non-negotiable tenacity that his loyalties lay in just one corner of all existence, the messenger and his message. And that was enough for him. Secondly, the book, Nahjul Balagha. These are the words by the greatest and the most intelligent eyewitness of the Prophet's life. In the divine plan, the fact that he was 30 years the Prophet's junior made him just right. At the age of 10, he was witness to the revelation. And thereafter, every moment of the Prophet was seen and observed by him. He saw the luminous stage of the world lit by the spotlight of God. Modern readers often find the reading tedious. They think that it is like a book where the pages reflect time, but that is not true. This book is a collection of sermons and speeches given at diverse times and to diverse audiences. The notes of a good edition fill in the details that are needed to see with the eye of the imagination what is needed to place the sermon or moment in context. And so the modern reader must understand and forgive some of the features of the text as it is before him. He must respect that oratory and rhetoric which are lost arts in this busy world of email and faxes, had different rules in the Arabian culture to which this man is heroically speaking. The reader must see that it was a style imposed upon both the speaker and the audience expected the speaker to first introduce himself and give the evidence of the claims that he is about to make. Bear all this in mind when you hear some of the sermons on the occasions of battles. But most painfully of all, when he talks of the events that overtook the Ummah after the Prophet's departure, try to hear the great regret at the way the message has been betrayed by those who should have embraced it. But he is in his element when he speaks of the reality of Allah, the just and justifying order of the universe. When he speaks of the realities of the next world, as if it was almost upon him, seen by his own eyes. When he speaks of the previous prophets and their faces and hair, all this creates for us a richness in human language, reflecting the Quran's richness of narrative in the language of God. It has been noted that the Prophet speaking, as he was to all mankind, managed to retain a simplicity that allowed him to reach all minds, at whatever level they may be. But Hazrat Ali was not so constrained. This allowed him to go into the higher philosophical issues that were embedded in the message but needed fleshing out and elaboration. He is excellent at this, and when a part of a sermon hits you with an insight into life and living, into Allah and His message, into this world of time and beyond, know that this is the peak of eloquence the world so badly needs, and how privileged you are to have it.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sermon number 1. In this sermon, Imam Ali mentions the genesis of creation of the heavens, earth, and Adam. Glory to Allah in the highest, whose glorification cannot be described in words, whose blessings and bounties cannot be enumerated by reckoners and enumerators, and homage due to him cannot be paid even by the most assiduous and persevering attempters. No one can fully understand or explain his being, however hard he may try. Reason and sagacity cannot visualize him. Intelligence, understanding, and attainments cannot attain the depth of knowledge to study or scrutinize the Godhead. Human faculties of conception, perception, and learning, and attributes of volition, intuition, and apprehension cannot perceive him or fathom the extent of his might and glory. His attributes cannot be defined, limited, or circumscribed. There do not exist words in any language to specify or define his qualities, peculiarities, characteristics, and singularities. He is eternal. Therefore, no time could be imagined to say that he existed since then. Similarly, no period could be assigned for the duration of his existence. The creation of the universe, the universal expansion of primordial gas, and its gradual solidification in the form of mountains, acting as pegs in the bosom of earth, are all due merely to his omnipotence. The first step of religion is to accept, understand, and realize him as the Lord. Thorough understanding lies in conviction and confirmation, and the right conviction is to sincerely believe that there is no God but he. The true belief in His oneness is to realize that He is so absolutely pure and above nature that nothing can be added to or subtracted from Him. Because one should realize that there is no difference between His person and His attributes. Whoever accepts His attributes to be an addition to His being abandons the concept of monotheism and believes in duality, He and His attributes. Such a person, in fact, believes Him to exist in parts. One who holds such a belief cannot form a true concept of Allah. He is ignorant and will always try to believe in some creation of his imagination as his God. And whoever holds such a belief accepts limitations in his being and confines him to a place or to particular attributes and brings him on a level with his creatures. To believe that he is invested with the characteristic of residing in a particular place, heaven or earth, and to point towards him accordingly, or to believe that he is restricted to a special position or occasion, that is to localize him, or to consider that certain place or time can exist without him and can be void of his omniscience and omnipresence, is a conception which results in assigning Godhead to a numerical unity. To assign a place to him by considering him within or over a place means to subject him to the limitations of space and to allot him an importance secondary to space. It also means to believe that some place can exist outside the sphere of his omnipresence. His existence is eternal. He neither came into being at some period of time, nor was he created. His being did not come into existence from non-entity. He is with everything, but not physically and bodily. He is away from everything, but not by way of bodily distance or of being unconcerned and indifferent to it. He acts and works, but his action or work does not require any movement or help of any parts of body, instruments or machinery. He had vision, even when there was nothing to see. He is one and alone, because he has no companion who would keep his company or whose absence he would miss. He originated the creation without passing through any anxiety and without first trying experiments and benefiting by the results or improving the models, and without finding himself obliged to move about, forced to carefully work out a particular plan or line of action. Allah, the Almighty, destined things, that is matter and energy, to be dissolved into time. He so arranged and consolidated these factors, matter, time and space, that the intensity of their diverse and opposing properties was reduced. As soon as things came into existence, they were allotted properties and place in nature. And soon after creation of things, order for expansion and extension was given. And just as things were obeying this order, each one of them was given a form and a body. Thus, every created thing, from the cosmic ray down to the most complicated form of life, and every object had a place permanently fixed, was assigned a position in nature which no one can change. In this arrangement, there was nothing accidental, but everything had a pre-arranged and predestined place in nature. Allah knew the very details of everything before He brought each of them into existence. His knowledge covered the near and distant effects of the coming into being, evolution and destruction of everything which was created. The Almighty Lord assigned places to these objects in space, and to gain this end, the primordial gas or yelm started breaking its continuity and consistency, thereby dividing into nebulous masses. The space was ordered to expand and to provide in its vastness places for this expanding nebulous mass. This stupendous mass of fluid was swirling and sweeping, and the shaking conglomeration was in an extremely disturbed and turbulent state. In it, huge waves, millions of miles high, were rising. The force of spontaneous expansion was acting. The most powerful stormy wind was rolling, rotating, shaking, drifting, sweeping, and forcing this fluid mass into outer regions of the space. At this stage, the force of expansion received the order to reverse to the system of condensation. All this time, the enormous velocity of expansion was kept under perfect control. He then bound the whole system within limits. At this juncture, Allah brought into existence a third force, resembling a highly strong wind. It stopped further thinning of the fluid helm and forced it back towards the center of the gravitation. Therefore, tremendous disturbances were raised in its body. This third force began acting upon it, creating fresh waves and forming fresh eddies, like curd being converted into thin buttermilk and thick small globules of butter. This wind, the third force, was acting very strongly in diverse ways. On the one hand, it turned the whole body of matter and energy in such a way that every part of it was equally and uniformly under its influence, till the helm took up the form of something resembling foam and froth, which formed islands of thicker matter in the sea of thinner matter. Each foam and eddy was a galaxy. Thus the Lord created galactic clusters, seven skies, one beyond the other. The lowest cluster was to act as a base or center from which expansion was developed in all directions, and others, galactic clusters, looking like roofs, one over the other. The galaxies were, and are still today, floating in space without any support, occupying their places without any prop. He then allowed each galaxy to be adorned with its luminous suns or stars, planets reflecting lights of suns, and satellites, moons, while every one of them, stars and satellites, was decreed to rotate on its orbit within the limits of the constantly rotating roof galaxy. After having opened up the space, Allah filled it with different kinds of angels. Some of them, since their creation, have engaged themselves in prostration and have not got and will not get a chance to rise to the bowing posture, ruku. Some are bowing and will never stand up, while there are some who are standing in a file worshipping and will never leave their places or move.
Some are constantly glorifying Him since their creation and will continue it without a break to the end of their existence.
They never get tired, nor the constant work annoys them. All angels are so created that exhaustion and fatigue do not betake them, and oversight, negligence, or forgetfulness do not affect them. Some of them are trustees of His revelation and act as messengers carrying His commandments to His prophets and apostles. Some of them are guardians of His creatures, while others are guards of paradise. Some are so created that they extend from one part of the space to the other, even reaching beyond the limits of space. The grandeur of His might and glory has dazzled them, and realization of their own humility and meekness overpass them. His might and power screens them from the eyes of His other creatures. Having realized His greatness, they do not associate Him with any form, figure, appearance, shape, or size. Neither do they ascribe attributes of His creatures to Him, nor confine Him to a place or position, nor compare or liken Him to anything. Some commentators consider the following sermon to be Sermon 2. Allah then gathered together earth having various properties, hard, soft, saline, acidic, etc., having different colors and humors. He moistened it and allowed it to ferment till it became one cohesive mass and took up a form, perhaps amino acid. He then allowed this shapeless mass, having to take up a shape, various twists and curves in its body and many limbs, joints and segments. He then allowed this figure to remain for a period known to him, till its central structure of bones started getting solidified and became solid and strong enough to support the whole figure and to bear its weight. It continued like that for a period of time, and then he infused into it the divine spirit, and the figure stood up as a man. This creation was an intelligent and rational being, using intellect instead of instinct, and having complete control of mental faculties and full command over his limbs. He further had natural sagacity and wisdom to differentiate between right and wrong, between truth and falsehood, and between justice and injustice. And he could distinguish between various tastes, colors, smells, as well as between different species of things, plants and animals around him. This creature, man, had a body constituted and composed of substances having contradictory, conflicting and divergent properties as well as compatible, agreeing and harmonious qualities, having intrinsic heat and cold and latent humidity and dryness. Having created and perfected such a being, he ordained the angels to hand over the trust committed to their care and to fulfill the promise they had made, which was to accept his superiority and to recognize his greatness. He therefore ordered them all to pay their homage to him and to bow down before him. They all obeyed his command, except the Satan, who had a prejudice against Adam, and his bigotry led him to rebel against his orders and to behave impudently. He was arrogant of his origin of fire and humiliated Adam upon his origin of clay. Wrath of Allah be upon him, and he was given time till the day of judgment. Allah then allowed Adam to live in a place where he could pass his time happily, free from every kind of sorrow and grief. Adam was fully warned of Satan's enmity with him and his evil intentions against him. When the Satan saw Adam living in such a happy surrounding and having such a good company, he again felt jealous of him and allured him out of his place, position and status. Unfortunately, Adam could not see through the deception and changed the firm belief which he ought to have in the advice of Allah to doubt in the usefulness of this advice, that Satan is jealous of him and will harm him. And instead of a strong courage to act in obedience to the advice and according to his conviction, he faltered and fell into the trap. He thus changed his happy and carefree condition into that of uncertainty, fear, disappointment and shame. After his first lapse, Adam felt ashamed of his weakness and repented. Allah the Merciful accepted his penitence and taught him the way to seek his forgiveness, favor and grace, and promised to take him back to paradise. But for the time being, he sent him to the place where he had to strive for his living, a place where he could have children and his race could multiply. Allah selected his prophets from the descendants of Adam, took covenants from them to faithfully act according to his revelations and to propagate his message. The system of appointing messengers and prophets was adopted when many people broke their covenant given to Allah and went back upon their words, forgot their duties and divine rights, began accepting others as their gods and started worshipping them, because Satan had induced them to give up the ways of Allah and to forsake his worship. Allah sent his prophets continuously, one after the other, so that they might remind human beings of the duties which nature had laid upon them as a part of the plan of their existence and as the fulfillment of the promises made by their spirits on the day of creation. These prophets were to draw the attention of humanity towards the inherent covenant and the blessings and bounties bestowed upon them by Him, to convey His messages to them, to teach them to wisely use the treasures hidden in their minds and intellects,
and also to direct them to understand the manifestations as well as the secrets of nature,
such as the high roof over their heads, the sky, which protects them from destructive and devastating effects of the space, the land spread under their feet with all its treasures and bounties,
the ways and means of their subsistence and civilization, so abundantly and profusely provided,
the diseases which weaken them, the misfortunes and calamities which often befall them, and lastly the death, which brings an end to everything. Allah the Almighty has never left His creation without guidance and education through His prophets, without a divine book, without conclusive and effective proof, and without a clear path to salvation. His prophets were men of such strength of character and courage that though they were often in minority, and those who opposed them always had the majority, yet they never felt nervous, disappointed or baffled, and never forsook their missions.